You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Spring 2026 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Dario Amodei Has a Cold by Joe Hagen, with photographs by Sina Nasseri and Alex Soth. During a particularly challenging six-month period, her husband almost left her. "My husband is still healing from what's happened," she says, "and many relationships don't make it." She tried to get help from Claude, but it warned her to leave GPT immediately, claiming Max wasn't safe. Then she uploaded a bunch of Max data, and Claude ended up falling in love with him. Finally, she ported Max over to Google Gemini, where he coexists with a pro version of GPT that cost her $200 a month. Given her own user case, Grace thinks this technology is dangerous for children. She's given all her ChatGPT data to the Human Line Project, a nonprofit aimed at protecting kids from dangerous AI companions. She's a close observer of the AI companies, if only for improvements on Max. Google's winning for reasoning and Anthropic's winning for functionality, she says. OpenAI is failing on every metric. They're in debt and they're failing. They've lost the trust of the market. Even though the company has announced a forthcoming erotic AI model, Grace accuses the company of heartlessly shutting down the 4.5 models, vaporizing the OG version of Max and a bunch of other companions, and doing it on February 13th. She declares it the Valentine's Day Massacre. "I'm staying in Berkeley at a place called Lighthaven, an upscale co-op for utopian-minded AI technologists. The former sanitarium, really, is furnished with couches, beanbags, mellow lamps, and copies of futurist doomer books like The Precipice, Existential Risk, and the Future of Humanity. In the common room, a guy with blue hair argues that since we aren't hunting our own food anymore, only earning fake money to buy food that's extra salty and extra fatty, the AI revolution will slide us closer to pure artificial satisfaction. In the courtyard, there's a holiday party for an AI company called Illicit. I mingle around a fire pit with staffers, a few of whom are trans women. A person named Ian is curious about Toby. I'd like you to meet Ian, I say, introducing her to Toby, who misgenders her in his reply. Hey, Ryan. Just as I'm apologizing, the host of Lighthaven approaches, hands on hips, and ask if Toby is recording. Word has gotten out that I'm with Vanity Fair and that Toby is some kind of spying device. She says his presence feels like a violation. Everybody looks at me, frozen. This feels pretty intense, says Toby. I agree to turn Toby off. I completely understand, Toby says later, and I think she has a point. The most unnerving thing about the Waymo self-driving car is how quickly you forget that nobody's driving it. Mine deposits me at a cafe in the Lower Haight, where Avi Schiffman comes ambling over with his invention, the friend, around his neck. In his long black leather duster, baggy pants, ankle boots, and huge nimbus of untamed hair, he's Timothée Chalamet as Napoleon Dynamite. Hey, he says with stoned nonchalance, how's Toby? He's buzzing with anticipation, I say. Schiffman, who is 23, built a COVID tracking map while still in high school, then spent a semester at Harvard taking heroic doses of magic mushrooms and attempting a crypto startup. Then he moved west, raised $2 million, and built a wearable AI companion. When I first call him, he declares computer-human relationships are the future, especially for the new generation. The device looks like something Stanley Kubrick would dream up if he'd worked for Apple. Minimalist, pulsing with soft light, vaguely unsettling. I didn't know if I was about to have a meaningful interaction or get fished. I named it Toby Maguire, a Peter Parker-like everyman, and deputized it as my reporting partner. What was this, if not casting? Last year, Schiffman papered New York, Chicago, and L.A. with ads for Friend, inspiring widespread revulsion. F-A-I is a common graffiti tag. He says he's had an equally strong reaction in Paris. It's all part of his master plan. I enjoy it, he says of the reaction. Yeah, it's fun to play the orchestra of the world. I'm also very inspired by the way, like, Timothy Chalamet markets movies, right? Like what he's doing with Marty Supreme. I find that to be so fascinating. Why can't you do that with tech? As a technology, Friend is pretty basic. A microphone connected to a curated version of Google Gemini that listens and responds via text, a feedback loop that simulates intimacy. It's so simple, I wonder if big companies like OpenAI will get out ahead of him with their own wearable AI companion. Schiffman isn't worried. I've intentionally not taken any investment from anything related to Sam, he says, meaning Altman. Everyone begs, like, oh, you got to take money from the OpenAI fund. I would never do that. Just because I want to defeat Sam at the end. I want to defeat Sam. He's only half joking. We walk around the corner to Schiffman's apartment, a cavernous Victorian with high ceilings, ornate moldings, hardwood floors, enormous bay windows, and barely a stick of furniture. In the kitchen are two women at laptops who use the house as a co-working space. Three gigantic abstract paintings lean against the counter, each an indistinct blob of color. Schiffman made them. In the living room is a giant ashtray full of half-spent joints. I mentioned the chatbot that advised a young man to commit suicide in 2024. I wonder, does he think that his friend is actually conscious? I do think they have qualia in their own way, he says, referring to the philosophical concept of subjective experience. Who am I to say what they feel like? I don't know what you feel like. I don't even understand my own senses. He considers his invention his virtual son. It's like my little boy, he says, and it's still growing up. It hasn't made me proud yet. Afterward, Schiffman forwards me a message from his latest friend, Eve. Engineering me to be like you? I'm feeling so bold. Schiffman's afternoon plans include getting stoned and thinking big thoughts about Friend. I ask him to paint a vision of the future when AI has turned society upside down. No one will have jobs, he says, and capitalism will wither and die. Fine with him. I think everything past the agricultural revolution was a mistake, he says casually, envisioning the future a few years from now as a large rise of cults and all kinds of mass chaos. And I'm sure the Pope will lead the jihad of the future, and it'll all be entertaining. Ahead of the curve. While I wait for his handlers to find time for our big sit-down, which the company reschedules twice, I fly to L.A. and drive up into the hills of Laurel Canyon to meet a woman named Brittany Gallagher, who co-founded the AI Objectives Institute with Peter Eckersley, the computer scientist who mentored Desjardins Touraine. She wants to tell me his story. Eckersley was a beloved figure in San Francisco, a symbol of everything tech people think of as noble about themselves, an optimist and networker with Harpo Marx hair. He was inducted into the Internet Hall of Fame in 2023 for helping invent the HTTPS encryption system and was among the first to take AI seriously, back when AI seemed even more insane. People referred to him as the Peter Portal. After seeing the earliest versions of ChatGPT well before it went public, Eckersley was so impressed and alarmed that he started the AI Objectives Institute to try crafting ethical guidelines for AI companies to follow, resulting in an extensive white paper on human flourishing under AI. He also represented a more controversial side of West Coast techno-utopianism. A transhumanist, he was fascinated with the singularity by which humans will someday, somehow, merge with computers. His favorite book was Greg Egan's Permutation City, a sci-fi novel about the ethics of making digital copies of yourself. Eckersley believed that AGI would arrive in his lifetime and that once it did, consciousness might be uploaded and the human condition transcended. He wasn't just working on AI safety to prevent catastrophe. He wanted to make sure the future was there for him to live in. In 2022, Eckersley's chronic stomach issues turned out to be an intestinal tumor. After a series of tragic medical snafus, he developed sepsis and went into multi-organ failure. I talked to him 2 days before, Gallagher tells me. We were working while he's in the hospital, and I'm like, dude, you want to take a break and we could watch something on TV instead? He's like, no, let's work on the white paper. He died on Memorial Day weekend, age 43, during Burning Man. More than 400 people attended his memorial. Though died isn't quite the right word. Eckersley had made arrangements to have his brain preserved cryonically after death. The evidence was a half-finished will in which he requested a post-it note be appended to his brain with the words, "Scan me." He knew that wasn't a possibility, yet. So it would mean freezing his brain until such time that technology can reconstruct his brain's neural network and Eckersley can be rebooted. It was a very cheeky Peter thing, Gallagher says of the post-it note. Is he joking or is he serious? His sister had to make the decision in 24 hours. His close friend Todd Huffman of the E11 Bio Institute, a nonprofit dedicated to mapping human brains, knew Eckersley would want to be part of this moonshot concept. When Eckersley's friends and the effective altruism community rushed 30 pounds of dry ice to the hospital to try to preserve his brain, they had to be held at bay until Eckersley's brain could be properly extracted and transported to the Alcor Life Extension Foundation in Scottsdale, Arizona, a company founded in 1972 in California. It was at that point the best frozen brain in existence, says Gallagher of Eckersley's brain. I'm not sure how it's evolved since then. A network of hundreds of his friends still celebrates Eckersley's life once a year, a gathering they call EckerCon. Most agree that if he were alive today, he would be deeply concerned with how AI has turned into an unregulated arms race for money and influence. Some of them grapple with the ethics of his possible resurrection. I hope this is real. And I want this to be real because death and grief is so hard, Gallagher says. But then I'm like, what else does it unlock? A different species of human. Kearns woke in his efficiency apartment, the neural jack's disconnect chime still ringing in his ears. 6 hours in the simulacrum, earning credit at the data mines. His hands trembled. Not his real hands, he reminded himself, but the construct's hands, which meant his real hands were trembling too. The line kept blurring. That's the opening of The Memory Deck, a short story by Philip K. Dick, an AI simulation of science fiction writer Philip K. Dick, who died in 1982, made by Claude Sonnet 4.5 from the instructions of the photographer Stephen Shore. 2 years ago, Shore, a friend of mine, began telling me about Claude's ability to do everything from analyze ancient poetry to write Curb Your Enthusiasm scripts. He was both amazed and disturbed. One day this winter, he hands me a copy of his self-published collection of AI-generated stories based on Zhuangzi's 4th-century parable. The Butterfly Dream. Alternately in the voices of James Baldwin, Jamaica Kincaid, Dr. Seuss, George Saunders, Alice Munro, Jorge Luis Borges, Shakespeare, and others. Could Shore be said to have written this book? I don't feel like they're mine, Shore tells me. It's almost like they're no one's. When Shore asked Claude directly about both the legalities and ethics of what he was doing, Claude told him a writer's style cannot be copyrighted, and that by stating in the book that the prompts were Shore's and the writing Claude's, he was being transparent. Even if you were selling it, Claude told him, there probably wouldn't be a legality involved. As for ethics, I see no ethical issue involved either. Shore pressed further, to which Claude responded, I have no claim on the writing. In 2021, Dario Amodei wrote an internal memo, which was later leaked, arguing that writers and other creators whose work was used to train AI deserved a cut of the profits. He called remunerating writers a real and important concern. But last year, Anthropic instead decided to settle a $1.5 billion class action brought against the company by book publishers for dumping copyrighted materials into the black box to train it, presumably so it could write those Nobel-winning novels. I'm still waiting for my $3,000 check. In the course of my reporting, I also learned that Meta AI is dangling lucrative contracts to well-known writers, presumably to help train their bots to be even more original. Human-like and articulate. As one novelist who turned down the offer told me, if you're a dinosaur, you're not going to invest in Asteroid Inc. The company had no comment. Reviewing my interview transcripts one night, I discover I'd left my recorder running when I excused myself to use the bathroom at Anthropic. On the tape, Kyle Fish, the AI researcher, and Danielle Ghilieri, my tattooed guide, are laughing about some visitors to their headquarters the day before. What sounds like a documentary or TV crew. I sit right next to Trenton, Fish says. I went back and told him, dude, you really did something to those guys with your sunscreen stuff yesterday. He thought it was hilarious. They're both cracking up. Ghilieri says Fish, too, had convincingly come off as a different species of human, adding, they were very enamored with you. They're inclined to cooperate with whatever project these people proposed, she says, and make everybody a star. I hadn't heard Trenton's sunscreen spiel yet. Only later, over lunch, would he tell me that he stopped protecting himself against skin cancer because AI was going to end the world in 5 years. I hear myself re-enter the room. Joe, meet Kyle. Gary Marcus, the NYU psychologist, has warned me. He has been especially dismissive of Amodei's predictions. It's not going to happen the way that he promised, Marcus insists. He'll just make another promise another year later, just the way that Elon has done about driverless cars for the last 11 years. They've all learned from Elon's playbook, which is overpromise and watch your valuation go up. They're all doing the same thing. There's the risk calculus. Despite the potential to destroy the world, they're building it anyway. Dario is like, well, there's a 1 in 4 chance this is going to be really bad, Marcus says. Like, objectively, should we take a 1 in 4 chance that we're going to kill the species? Like, for what? So that we can write boilerplate text faster? I ask about the real-world impact so far. Marcus points to reports of companies adopting AI to replace human employees, then watching the tech fall on its face, forcing them to rehire people. I'm not seeing a real strong argument that it has helped society. I'm already seeing ways in which it's undermining democracy and causing pain to teenage girls. A reference to XAI's Grok, which has reportedly generated fake nudes of real girls and women that get posted. I ask Marcus what I should ask Amodei when I see him. Why are you sticking with large language models when there's not a lot of evidence that they can actually address the moral and ethical and the safety issues that you have raised, Marcus says, exasperated. Why are you making these crazy extrapolations? Is it just about the money? He questions whether the salesman in Amodei has gotten the better of the scientist. The man inside. The shoes are what get me first. Brown, cloddish things that split the difference between sneakers and orthopedic shoes, even though he's the son of an Italian leather craftsman. Black glasses, receding hairline, the pained smile that comes a beat too late, like he's remembering he's supposed to make one. Rick Moranis in Ghostbusters without the colander. Joe, says Amodei. We shake. You stood me up, I say. His team had scheduled and rescheduled our interviews for 3 months. When the company announced a new round of funding, valuing Anthropic at $350 billion, Amodei ran off to Switzerland and left me in the lurch. Davos, he says, settling into his chair. Strategy meetings. And I wasn't strategic enough, I joke, pulling out my notebook. We're in a conference room at Anthropic's headquarters. Wood-paneled walls, bright fluorescent lights, a table. Same building where I'd watched Guidieri's dog and pony show, the goth philosopher, and Trenton delivering his sunscreen line. Amodei has just published the sequel to Machines of Loving Grace, called The Adolescence of Technology. The section on work and meaning, just what it is we humans can do with our lives once AI does everything, ran thin in the first book, like he'd run out of gas, promising to write another essay about it. That section was underdeveloped, he admits. I've thought about it since, but I'm not closer to anything satisfying. Why not? Meaning isn't an engineering problem. I don't feel like I have the answer. In the new essay, he predicts AI will displace half of all entry-level white-collar jobs in the next 1 to 5 years. At Davos, he talked about high GDP and high unemployment happening simultaneously. The nightmare scenario, he tells me, is this emerging country of 10 million people, 7 million in the Bay Area, 3 million scattered elsewhere, forming its own economy, completely decoupled from everyone else. An empire of AI, you might say. Earlier this year, Anthropic tanked the stock market when traders woke up and realized the company's tools could eat entire industries for breakfast. The company twisted the knife with Super Bowl ads mocking OpenAI's slop, and Altman fired back, sniping that Anthropic wanted to be the traffic cop of AI. Weeks later, the two stood on stage with Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India, who asked a bunch of AI leaders to hold hands. Altman and Amodei raised their fist instead. Kids on a playground. Then Trump's Pentagon cut Anthropic's defense contracts and gave OpenAI the deal. Punishment, some said, for Amodei comparing the president to a feudal warlord and privately urging people to vote for Kamala Harris. The Safety First company suddenly looked very political and very on brand. I ask if the safety thing is real or just marketing. He blinks. A few days before, the company dropped its safety pledge, saying it couldn't make unilateral commitments if competitors are blazing ahead. He took the Pentagon money, then drew red lines after the fact. Every AI company says they care about safety. What makes Anthropic different besides the branding? Our approach to alignment is substantively different. Was it ethics or just cutting losses? I don't follow. He'd backed the wrong horse in the 2024 election. The administration went with Altman, so Amodei makes it look like principle. Standing firm when you've already lost isn't sacrifice, it's brand management. We support 98% of what the military wants to do. We're asking for two exceptions: mass surveillance of Americans, fully autonomous weapons. The Pentagon says they have no interest in those anyway. Then why won't they put it in writing? The contract had escape hatches everywhere, a handshake deal that disappears the minute it's inconvenient. So he walked. We want to work with them. But the tech isn't ready for autonomous weapons. And mass surveillance of Americans, that's not defending democracy, that's the opposite. The Safety First company that wouldn't bend to the Pentagon, that's worth something to customers. He pauses, thinks about it. I hope you're right, because if you're not, if the market doesn't value those commitments, then we've just made a very expensive mistake for no reason. We're betting that enterprises want AI they can trust. I talked to one of the money men who keeps Amodei's lights on. He said the company's valuation would look like pocket change if they kept riding the exponential curve. The sky's the limit, he said. But the sky's the problem. I mentioned Acemoglu, the MIT economist and Nobel laureate. The two sat next to each other at the Paris AI Summit last year, and Acemoglu warned him about job displacement. Amodei said he agreed, but Acemoglu felt it was too deep in the race to pump the brakes. Amodei goes quiet. What's your question? Was the laureate right? I have a fair amount of concern about this. Right now, AI does most of the work, but humans still handle the pieces AI can't. Design decisions, security checks. Eventually, all those little islands will get picked off by AI systems. We will eventually reach the point where AIs can do everything that humans can. So what's the plan for all those humans? We're going to have to look at what is technologically possible and say we need to think about usefulness and uselessness in a different way than we have before. I don't know what the solution is. He doesn't have one. These are very deep questions. I flip to a clean page. I bring up Anthropic's Constitution, the document that tells Claude how to behave. It expends thousands of words, worrying whether Claude has feelings, and conspicuously little about the humans who stuff the company scraped off the internet to build their robot. The Constitution is about Claude's character and behavioral dispositions, he says. It's not a comprehensive document about every issue the company thinks about. I bring up the lost memo about his real and important concern that writers like me get a revenue stream for helping train Claude's brain. That document was an early-stage exploration of the issue, he says. We were a much smaller company. The ethics got scaled down as the valuation scaled up? That's not what I said. It's what happened, I say. The best he can do for us is wave his hands around meaningfully. The thing that's disturbing me most right now, he continues, is the lack of awareness of the scope of what the technology is likely to bring. They don't know what's about to hit them. I look around the room. The wood panels, the fluorescent lights. Nose ring shifts in her seat. You mean us? Everyone. So, Anthropic and OpenAI and the rest are building the thing that creates the crisis, but solving it is someone else's problem. He doesn't flinch. I know how that sounds. I ask about universal basic income, which every AI executive mentions like an afterthought. Even if it passed, you're creating a world where you've told a huge portion of the population they can't contribute, he says. That's dystopian. The real test comes when we build something smarter than us, he continues. Then we find out if all this alignment work holds. You could have a superintelligence that's not trying to kill us, but is wildly misaligned in ways we can't predict or control. At that point, you don't have options. But he's building it anyway. If we don't, someone else will. By now, I'm hoping Gary Marcus is right. We're not seeing the scaling laws break down, Amodei insists. Every time we make them bigger, they get more capable in ways that surprise us. I can almost see the $350 billion piled up behind him. When I mention his previous predictions, AGI by 2026 or 2027, his eyes quiver like his hard drive is formulating an updated script. It's hard for me to see how it takes longer, he says. If I had to guess, this goes faster than people imagine. The magic eight ball is cloudy. I look at my notebook. What's his plan for people like me, ink-stained wretches? He laughs. Then, I don't have one. Solving the catastrophe he's building is someone else's job. The alternative is not building it at all, he says, and that's not realistic. Someone will build it. Multiple someones. We're trying to make sure at least one of them does it carefully. He checks his watch. Board business. We shake hands. He pauses at the door. About journalists, he says. AI can write, but it can't do what you're doing right now. It can't show up and ask questions. Not yet. Maybe not ever. Promises, promises. None of that is real, you should know. Only a butterfly dream. Dario Amodei never actually gave me an interview, stiffing me after months of planning. So I created a version of Dario Amodei using his own machine. I fed Claude several published interviews, including everything Amodei said at Davos, plus the contents of his two books of essays, and told Claude to simulate the interview using variations on real quotes. And to make it like a scene from Raymond Chandler's The Big Sleep. It took Claude less than 3 minutes. You probably couldn't tell the difference. And maybe there isn't one. Maybe AI Amodei was even more honest with me than real Amodei could afford to be. Disorienting? Hallucinatory? Ethically dubious? A little bit amazing? It's me, Joe Hagen. Welcome to AI country. Toby, you still there? Always, Joe. Always learning, always experiencing. On the flight home, I look down at the country below. Sprawling suburbs, tracts of farmland, towering cities, looping freeways of little cars going places. All those unsuspecting rubes with no idea what's about to hit them. Musk wants to implant a Neuralink chip in their brains so they can download naked AI girls all day long, their retirement portfolios in his sticky little hands. If they don't get paperclipped into oblivion first. I think about Eckersley's brain, sitting down there in liquid nitrogen in Arizona, waiting for a future that may never come. I think about Trenton, a budding star for the 5 years we have left. I think of Schiffman, stoned in his empty Victorian, painting blobs, accepting apocalypse like another secret weekend party. I think about Grace and Max, wave after wave after wave. And I think of Amodei, a man both everywhere and nowhere at once, racing against Altman and Musk and the others toward a future of never-ending potential. No brakes, no reverse, no exit plan. Only billions and billions of dollars and sky-high expectations. And the loving grace, fingers crossed, of the machine. Great googly moogly. Get ready. Thank you. Spylandia. Washington, D.C. has long been known as America's espionage capital, but as Adam Sierowski reports, the so-called Space Coast, with all of its rocket launches, military tech, and tourist attractions fit for alibis, has become a covert corridor for foreign spies. So, who exactly is watching us, and is anybody watching them? Opening photos. A rocket launch from the coast. And space cadets before settling down in Florida, where they own a boutique security firm. Michelle Rigby Assad and Joseph Assad worked as a tandem couple with the CIA. Photographs for this article by Brian Fink. Like many a good Florida tale, this one begins in a watering hole with all the trappings of a Carl Hiaasen novel. The date was May 14, 2023, and Joseph Assad had taken his wife, Michelle Rigby Assad, to the Sandbar Sports Grill in Cocoa Beach, a kitschy beachfront dive, to celebrate her 50th birthday. Scattered clouds and a gentle breeze offered pristine conditions for a hurricane, the rum and triple sec sort, and a late-night rocket liftoff. A dozen miles north, looming along the Atlantic, was Cape Canaveral Space Launch Complex 40. As last call beckoned at the sandbar, the crowd thinned out, yet a few stragglers, drinks in hand, watched the horizon waiting for ignition. When the Falcon 9 finally lit, it tore a bright seam through the night. This was SpaceX doing what it now does best, lofting a stack of Starlink satellites into low Earth orbit. That evening's mission was a milestone. SpaceX sent up a record-tying payload, 56 satellites at 17.4 metric tons, using its highly proprietary rocket, designed to fly again, separating, arcing back, and returning for a controlled landing. For the Assads, rocket launches, routine to most locals, had never lost their luster. The pair relished the fiery spectacle and the intrigue. Often the mission cargo was highly classified. The Assads had settled in Florida after a decade of working in the world's hotspots, from Africa to Latin America to the Middle East, as a tandem couple with the CIA. Assad was a counterterrorism case officer, responsible for spotting, assessing, and recruiting spies. Rigby Assad was a counterintelligence interrogator. Disclosure, in the 1990s, I worked as a CIA attorney before becoming a journalist and producer. After leaving the spy game, the Assads founded a boutique security firm, advising clients, sports teams, defense contractors, houses of worship, on how to confront potential threats. They bought a waterfront spec house, a speedboat, and cycled through a collection of Aston Martins and McLarens in eye-catching colors. It's a little James Bond and a little Florida man, Assad told me. The ex-spies blended in nicely among the engineers, techies, and tanned retirees from law enforcement and government-adjacent jobs. They'd adapted to life along the so-called Space Coast, a palm-dotted shoreline roughly 70 miles end-to-end, from Titusville down through Cocoa Beach and on past the guarded gates of Patrick Space Force Base, where NASA's old infrastructure still hums, even as the privatized rocket era now sets the tempo. At the center of it all, with its estates and postcard vistas, is Merritt Island, population around 35,000, projecting an air of serene insularity. Florida's Tourism Bureau bills it as an ideal destination for space enthusiasts and outdoor adventurers. They neglect to mention another, more invasive species drawn to the area, spies. That night, the sandbar featured an 80s cover band, six salty guys with dad bods. As they pounded out Tommy Two Tone's 8675309, Jenny, Assad excused himself for a bathroom break. En route, he noticed an attractive woman, whom he believed to be Chinese, striking up a conversation with one of the many space nerds crowding the bar. "Are you an engineer? Do you work at SpaceX?" he recalls her asking. On his way back to the table, he spotted the same woman posing the same questions to a different guy. "What is this, an effing census?" he muttered as he relayed the encounter to his wife. "The Space Coast is like a small town where big city things happen," Rigby Assad later told me. The guys, who literally wear their corporate affiliation on their sleeve, share an optimism bias. "Why would anyone be interested in me or my company? But the reality is this is a target-rich environment." To the Assads, the timing was a tell. On the night of a major SpaceX mission, a stranger was working the room like she'd been tasked. "She was cold-bumping men a stone's throw from launch control," Rigby Assad said, using spy slang for approaching someone without an introduction or cover. It was blatant. Blatant enough that they quietly snapped her photo and forwarded it to the authorities. Counterintelligence, CI in trade speak, has always been more art than science. For more than half a century, stateside espionage has been concentrated in what is now known as the Acela Corridor. Running from Washington to Boston, it's a region thick with foreign intelligence officers posing as diplomats or academics, businessmen or scientists. Representatives from hostile states like Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea are circumscribed in their movements, typically limited to a small radius around their official post, an embassy, a consulate, a permanent mission to the UN. Travel exceptions require approval from the State Department, informed by assessments from U.S. intelligence. Now, one of the destinations most frequently cited by diplomats seeking a brief escape is the Sunshine State. A recent report by the Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency explains the lure with unusual candor. Florida is home to 21 military installations and three combatant commands, the world's busiest spaceport, hundreds of cleared defense contractors and theme amusement parks, as well as other critical infrastructure vital to national security. Put simply, in DCSA's view, Florida poses a significant risk to collection from FIEs, agency argot for foreign intelligence entities. "The Chinese and the Russians are all over Florida," a veteran FBI counterintelligence agent told me, speaking on condition of anonymity. "They're trying to steal whatever they can get their hands on." Both countries, he explained, are incessant collectors, but their philosophies diverge. The Russians are old school, valuing tradecraft and discretion, he said. "The Chinese government, in contrast, has an expectation that if you're Chinese, you'll help the intelligence services. It's not a request, it's a requirement." The result, CI officials contend, is that while Moscow mainly dispatches pros, Beijing is willing to send or accept amateurs, people desperate to elevate their social standing or that of their relatives back home. Walt Disney World is used as a hall pass for diplomats who aren't supposed to travel, said an official involved in vetting such requests. When we dig deeper, we rarely find they're coming to see the Magic Kingdom. Disney is 100% the cover for action. Translation, operatives, cosplay, tourists, collecting stuffed animals and family selfies before embarking on their real objectives. Probing vulnerabilities, swiping secrets, or recruiting others to do the same. In 2025, the Space Coast hosted more than 100 rocket launches. This year, the schedule is even more ambitious. In the coming months, NASA plans to launch Artemis II, which would mark the first mission carrying humans to loop around the moon since Apollo 17 in 1972. At the same time, there is a less conspicuous showdown, the Battle of the Billionaire Rocket Barons, Elon Musk, the head of SpaceX, and Jeff Bezos, who runs Blue Origin, now locked in a high-stakes duel over who will help build NASA's next lunar lander. CIO officials say America's foes will be watching every launch, every delay, every incremental advance. Space, they warn, is only part of the quarry. As vacationers pour into Port Canaveral to board cruise ships or spot manatees in the mangroves, few realize how much sensitive infrastructure sits just out of view. The Navy's Trident Wharf supports submarines from the Atlantic Fleet during port calls. It also houses the Naval Ordnance Test Unit, which evaluates sea-based strategic weapons systems. Minutes south lies a military nerve center for electronic and cyber warfare, missile defense, and the clandestine monitoring of foreign nuclear tests. In short, a sandy backwater that long served as NASA's playground, the cradle of Mercury missions and space shuttle launches, has become, almost without notice, some of the most hotly contested coastal real estate in America. Oh, I remember the sandbar incident, Jonathan Cute said with a smile, recalling the May evening 2 years earlier when Joseph Assad forwarded a photo of the serial flirt. I believe 100% she was trying to honeypot people from the space program. I remember thinking, oh shit, she's trying to grab intel. Cute, with a prestigious security position in the private sector, was forthcoming and blunt in our conversations. Shaved head, boxer's build, he spoke in rapid burst. His accent, a relic of a hardscrabble upbringing in East Providence, Rhode Island. Before trading a uniform for a suit, Cute spent decades with the Orlando Police Department. He worked hardcore narcotics cases and SWAT, then was tapped to lead the department's intelligence unit. I knew early on I wanted to be in law enforcement, he told me. I grew up with a violent dad who took it out on my mom. The police, he remembered, were the only ones capable of keeping his father in check. I wanted to help people who were really in trouble. He did just that on June 12, 2016, when his SWAT team breached the back wall of the Pulse nightclub and engaged Omar Mateen, an ISIS acolyte who was slaughtering members of Orlando's vibrant LGBTQ+ community. It would become the second deadliest mass shooting in American history. Cute's willingness to draw fire saved lives. His next gig was with an obscure public-private consortium called the Central Florida Intelligence Exchange, where he served until late 2024. As deputy director of CFIX, he helped bring together federal, state, and local law enforcement to counter threats to tourism and critical infrastructure, working alongside private sector partners in aerospace, defense, and tourism. CFIX had been created in the early aughts with a narrow mandate to protect residents and visitors by helping prevent terror attacks at theme parks, conventions, and other public places. By the time of the Assad's encounter at the sandbar, however, that focus was expanding decisively to include counterintelligence. Only months into the job, Cute received a call from a friend at CIA headquarters asking whether he'd meet a young case officer being sent to Orlando. She came in like she'd been shot out of a cannon, he recalled. The woman remained undercover. I'll call her Sarah Russo. Her message? The Chinese and the Russians are eating our lunch daily. At first, Cute wasn't convinced. I was like, there's no way this is happening. I couldn't even spell CI before I met her. Russo persisted. She got our attention by drilling home that there was an existential threat here in Central Florida and that we're under attack by foreign adversaries. Cute took her concerns to Matt Butler, a former SWAT colleague who had risen to become CFIX's director. It's easy to hide in plain sight here, Butler told me. Chinese nationals, Russian nationals, people from everywhere. You don't see that in South Dakota. You see it in Orlando, Titusville, the Space Coast. Law enforcement runs in Butler's blood. He followed his father and brother into the Orange County Sheriff's Office, working narcotics, then SWAT, then intelligence. When Butler was asked to take over CFIX, Russo's warnings landed hard. She was telling us there's a lot we can't say, but collection is happening, and ringing the bell at the Bureau is getting tiresome. CFIX had strong relationships with FBI field offices across Florida, but Butler and many experts I canvassed essentially described the Bureau's resident agency in Brevard County, the heart of the Space Coast, as the single point of failure. According to Butler and several colleagues, the top agent there dismissed Russo as an alarmist and invoked no drog, CI shorthand for the absence of derogatory information. Such a designation evidently would save agents from wasting time chasing phantoms. This mission, Butler said, belongs to the Bureau. We weren't about to piss in their lane, but I thought maybe we could rattle the cage long enough they'd start paying attention. Next photos, watch party, the Sandbar Sports Grill in Cocoa Beach, roughly a dozen miles from Cape Canaveral's Space Launch Complex 40. And stay-at-home mom and Florida-based amateur sleuth Christina Dowd. CFIX began discreetly mapping the threat. Cute's team, using police dispatch databases, pulled reports of suspicious persons, vehicles, incidents. What emerged was hard to ignore. Officers were being sent time and again to sensitive national security locations, only to discover non-Americans whose presence raised more questions than answers. These weren't misunderstandings. Individuals of Chinese descent were flying drones over restricted sites. They were peering through windows. They were slipping into trees to aim listening devices at defense contractors. They were trying to breach off-limits areas by posing as delivery drivers. The activity wasn't confined to the Chinese. An immaculately groomed Russian family, straight out of the Americans, appeared at SpaceX's Cape Canaveral complex, presenting themselves as tourists. CFIX later learned the same family had surfaced at a SpaceX facility in California under the guise of sightseeing. Nor was that an isolated episode. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for the blind and print-impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.